The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 396 for Monday, May 7th, 2012. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions. We answer some questions. You send in your tips. We provide some tips. And together we all add some cool stuff found to the mix. We call it the Mac Geek Gab. And we all try to learn a little something new each time around. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Outstanding. How you doing today, John?
Excellent. Oh, had a nice bike ride this morning.
Oh, that's good.
Experimented with a gadget, which of course we're going to talk about and cool stuff found.
But no, talk now. About it now. Go.
Oh, here we go. I'm going to talk about it now. Yeah, sure. Mix things up here. Yeah. So, you know, you and I constantly get, you know, bombarded with all these toys that, you know, people want us to, not toys, I'm sorry, technology that people would like us to.
It's toys, John.
Yes, but, you know, we have to be professional here.
Right, professional.
Well, no,
toys.
But it's technology. So this is something that actually I had seen last year and had one sent to me, but then unfortunately it got kind of cold here, but it's from iBike. So iBike is a company that makes these little bicycle computers. And the particular thing that I have is called the iBike, I think, Dash CC, because what it does is so it's a combination of a case, and then you use your iDevice, either an iPhone or a iPod Touch, though you lose some functionality, obviously, most notably GPS, if you just use an iPod Touch. The one cool thing is, so, you know, I put this into the special case, which I guess has a dock connector or has some electronics in there. And as soon as I put it in there, it says, oh, this accessory needs some software. Would you like me to go to the App Store and download it? I'm like, oh, that is cool. It's the first time I've ever seen something do that.
Cool.
I mean, how cool, because I was wondering, I'm like, well, where's the software? I mean, they didn't include it. I mean, what's going on here? So that was really neat. And then they give you also a sensor that you put on your tire, and you put a little magnet and it detects the rotation. You give it, you know, the size of your tires and stuff like that. But the cool thing is, so it'll tell you, you know, based on the rotation, you know, your speed, and then also with the GPS, it can tell you your, so basically measures two things throughout your trip, or three things. I thought it was just two. So once you're done, you can send the ride data to your computer and use their software, and it shows you your speed and your elevation throughout your ride. But then you can export the data from, let's see, so I think they have a proprietary, I think it's some proprietary type of file called a IBD file. But then what you can do with that data is export it to a different format here. And let me find it. Where the heck is it? iBike rides to a KML file. And that's a file that you can load into Google Earth and it will show you your route superimposed on Google Earth.
Huh.
Which is really, really pretty darn cool, I think.
That's really cool.
So if you find it particularly cool, or, you know, you wondered, you know, maybe you were wandering about and had no idea where you were, but this thing records from start to finish the coordinates of your ride.
That's awesome. Wow. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, I thought it was. Their software, I get an uneasy feeling using their software. It doesn't do what I expect at times, but the core functionality looks very cool. So, you know, a really great tool if, and also while you're riding, it'll show you, you know, it can show you a map as well. So, you know, if you do get lost, you can get back to where you're going. So
right.
It's a neat tool. I forget how much it is. I thought it was $100 maybe, or no, $200. So it includes a case, and then, you know, you can download the software. So, and it's a, you know, ruggedized case, you know, looks weatherproof, but you can still operate your iDevice when it's inside of this thing.
From iBikeSports.com, it is $169. $169 might be cheaper elsewhere. And we can thank the team that's mowing my lawn now for the background music, I'll call that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, it's less. Okay, I got a match here. Okay, I guess the retail is $199, or they had a price drop. So
no, this is not. Well, this is on their website, so I would assume that that's them. So
yeah. Okay,
but yeah, they might have had a price drop, right? You got it last fall.
Yeah. Well, the price I paid was
No. So. Yeah. No, I know they sent it to you, but I'm saying in the materials you got from them last fall, it might have been, it might have, they might have dropped the price. Yeah. Cool. All right. You know, so we might as well do some cool stuff found here. Might as well mix things up. But also, one of the things you mentioned reminded me of a thing that I had added for cool stuff found, which I have placed an order for, real live cash money, but have not gotten yet because it's not out yet. And it's this new Pebble watch. This thing's pretty cool, John. Have you seen this Pebble? It's actually being funded via Kickstarter. They had a goal of, I don't know, something ridiculous, like $150,000 or something. And they're already up well over, I think they were well over 8 million the last time I looked. I'll look now. Yeah, they're almost at nine.
That's
million.
All I heard about it. Really, is that it may be like the top.
Oh, it is
as far as attracting funding. It may be the highest the highest amount of money that any project on Kickstarter has accumulated. So I looked it over. I wasn't too crazy about it.
Well, because, let me explain what Kickstarter is, so that in case people don't know, Kickstarter is a service, a website that people can use if they have an idea and they want to get funding for it. They essentially offer the ability for people to send them money for a project. Now, in most cases, that money is goes toward the purchase of whatever that product is, but not necessarily. You can, there have been projects where it's like, yeah, I just want to contribute some cash to this, and there's some level at which you can do that, and so there's various levels that you can contribute on this particular project. But the cool thing about this is that it's a watch. Now, those of you that know me know I'm kind of a mechanical watch freak. This has nothing to do with a mechanical watch other than it straps to your wrist. It uses e-paper, so the screen is always on. But it's programmable and also syncs with your iPhone via Bluetooth or your iPod Touch or I think there's an Android version. Yeah. So you can get it. Well, it's not a version. The same watch will work with iPhone or Android via Bluetooth. And there's apps for your phone, and there's also apps for the watch. And one of them is an app that reminded me of what you're doing here, where you put your iPhone in your pocket or whatever, and you have the watch on, and it tracks your bike ride and does all this other stuff for you. So I signed up to buy one of these things, and I'll get it in whatever September when they come out. But it's a cool thing. Even if you're not interested in purchasing one, check out the video at Kickstarter.com. All right. It is at Kickstarter. We'll put a link in the show notes to get you straight to the Pebble.
Yeah, I thought my only reservation is, in my mind, a watch shouldn't have a lifespan or battery. I mean, this thing, I think you got to charge it like once a week or something.
Yes,
like that.
That's true. You do need to charge it. That's right. Yep. That's a good point. Yeah.
To me, that's the only potential downside. And I don't know if it looked entirely comfortable, but we actually, the first I ran into Kickstarter, I guess you could call them kind of like a virtual VC system. And that you ask people for money to fund your product development. And if they send enough in, then
yep.
Yeah, the product gets developed and you typically are one of the first in line to get one.
That's right. Yeah. And if the product doesn't get funded, no one's money is spent. So if they hadn't hit their $100,000 goal, which obviously they have, and they're going to go ahead and build these things. But yeah, it's pretty good. I looked from first glance, it looked like it might be a little uncomfortable, and it may be. It looked actually a little tall. It looked large, but I compared its measurements to, watches that I wear regularly, and it actually seemed about the same dimensions, certainly the same height as, from lug to lug of watches that I've worn. So I'm actually looking forward to it. It should be a fun little toy, if nothing else.
Yeah, the first we ran into that, well, I remember now, is that it was, I think, two Macworlds ago, the Glyph.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually wrote a little article about this and mm-hmm. highlighted Kickstarter. But this is a combination stand and tripod mount for the iPhone 4.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the same thing. And it was just, to me, the cool part of the story was how these guys brought together the whole production of their product so quickly. I think they went from concept to getting funding to getting prototypes, outsourcing a lot of stuff to, I think it was like 5 months.
Yeah.
So that was a cool, and Kickstarter, of course,
you can hear all about that in Mac Geek Gab 312.
Oh, you found it.
I did.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. I'll link to the article too, because I did a little article about that because it just really impressed me. And it's the first time I saw the Square device. I saw these guys taking orders on the show floor and I'm like, wait, what's that thing you got stuck in your iPad? It's like, oh, it's a Square. You haven't seen this? I'm like, no. That's another one that I really like. Square. I don't know if you fiddled with one of those.
Yeah, I am. I'm just letting what do we want to call this? The ADD train go.
All right, back on whatever track we think we're on here.
No, it's good. You want to tell them about more about the Square thing, or are you good?
Square? I'm trying to figure a Square is.
It's a credit card. It's a credit card swiper for the iPhone.
Yes, and I think, do they have it for Android now?
Perhaps. Yeah. Yes, they do.
I think they may. So what they do, so it's a combination. It's a piece of hardware that plugs into the headphone or speaker jack on your iDevice. So I imagine what they're doing is they're converting the magnetic data to sound data. And then somehow, and I try taking one and putting it into like a speaker system to see if I can hear the sound. So I don't know exactly what they're doing. But yeah, but the revolutionary part about this is, as opposed to what small businesses typically have to go through to process credit cards, is that you don't have to rent a terminal. You don't have to. And the formula is very simple. They grab. They used to have, I think, a transaction fee and a percentage fee. Now I think it's just a straight percentage. So whatever it is, I think, if you go to their website, they see. But I thought it was like 2.something% or 3-something%. But it's so simple because the thing is, there's no membership. You're not renting anything. You cannot use it for months and you don't get any sort of penalty and you're not paying any sort of, recurring fee here.
Yep.
It was just a real breakthrough to allow pretty much anybody to take a credit card for not an outrageous fee, including individuals. When I got it, the first thing I did is I scanned my credit card and it credited my bank account like a day later, minus the transaction fee. And I'm like, wow, that's real easy.
To be fair, this adds the ability to do this on the fly with an iPhone. That's actually the big deal, because for small businesses, you could do this with PayPal for the last 5, maybe 10 years. And any person could take a credit card and take benefit from PayPal's ridiculously low merchant pricing and all that stuff. So the big deal with Square was that it added the ability to do this totally on the fly. And like you said, if you're swiping it, there is no per transaction fee. If you're typing the number in, there is a per transaction fee of 15 cents. Right.
And actually, so I'm on their page now. So iOS and the little robot. So it's Android, yep. Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and Discover. And it's a flat 2.75%.
Yep.
Which I'm sure upsets a lot of the other people that certainly charge more.
That's actually kind of high for.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's not terrible, but it's kind of high. Yeah. You could certainly get lower if you went and got your own merchant account, which really it really isn't difficult. We've got one for Mac Geek Gab, actually. So we've got one for Backbeat Media. It's easy. Anyway.
Oh, sure. But I think the breakthrough now is that they offer something called Square Register, which turns your iPad into basically a point of sale terminal. And that's fairly new that they rolled that out.
Yeah.
So, but it's cool. I mean, you can go to their webpage, squareup.com, and you can order, and the reader's free. That's the other thing. You're not paying anything for the reader.
Yep.
Well, because they make the money on the transaction fee.
It's absolutely. All right. Well, we're just going with cool stuff found. There's one actually that I've been wanting to mention for a little while here, and that is the iFrog Summit iPad case. You know, I was a big fan of the, and still am a big fan of the Magfolio from Spec. But because the new iPad is 10% thicker, which amounts to, 3 millimeters or something. But because it's 10% thicker than the old one, cases with very tight tolerance, like the Magfolio, do not fit on it. And Spec has assured me that they're working on a new one. And hopefully we'll see it soon. But in the interim, it's kind of nice because it's forced me to check out other cases, because the iPad really isn't functional for me anyway without a case and something to hold it up and stand it up. But I like it. It's a folio style case. It works. It's got the little magnet and it works properly with the iPad 3. The magnets do. So when you open it up or close it, activates and deactivates the screen. It's a little thicker than you would get with like the Magfolio, which is what I was used to. But it's thicker in a way that actually makes it feel very sturdy. So once I got over the thickness, I've really come to kind of like this thing. It feels very secure when it's in there. My only complaint about it, I have two. Number one, the magnet in the iPad isn't really strong enough to keep the lid from flopping open. It doesn't wrap around. It's just on it. So sometimes that's a problem. The other problem I will illustrate audibly here. It in order to sit it up on the case, you have to kind of flip it away from the back of the case, which is fine. It's how most of these folio cases work. But this one has Velcro to keep that from happening accidentally. But that's a problem if you're, say, in a library, or if I'm reading on my iPad in bed and, you know, Lisa's asleep or whatever, because there's this sound and it's pretty thick Velcro, you know, that's pretty loud. So that's my only real complaint about it. I like it. It's not a bad case. And I think it's $60 at iFrogs. This is the iFrog Summit case. And then I think you can get, like, you could spend more on it and get real leather. Mine just has, you know, pleather, faux leather, whatever they call it, but it looks fine and it's sturdy and all that good stuff. So that's the iFrog Summit case. You got anything else on your cool stuff found there list there, John? Or should I just read
absolutely
what we've got from listeners? All right, go.
Well, I'm gonna toss in one more here. So it's another toy.
Yeah.
That I got. So I recently did a review of the Samsung 470 series SSD, and it's very nice. Excuse me, very fast. SATA 2, and now they have a new one, the 8-something series, that's SATA 3, which didn't make much difference because my machine, my MacBook Pro, is SATA 1 and my Mac Mini is SATA 2. But still, one of the fastest SSDs that you're going to get out there, very light. The only downside, as with any SSD, is you're going to pay. So then, you know, I keep hearing...
What are they going to pay, John? You can't very well say they're going to pay, and then, you know,
When I looked at, so the 800 series, I think if you wanted to get a 512 gig of the 800 series, the latest one, I think you were talking almost $1,000. So,
okay. All right.
One of their products, high end products with the largest capacity, retailed for almost $1,000. So,
okay. Yeah. All right.
Again, it way more expensive than a rotational drive. But then, you know, I keep hearing about this, and, you know, I decided, I went to the very well-maintained database that we keep with all our secret contacts of people in the industry we can ask to give us stuff. And I went in there, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I want to contact Seagate or Seagate PR. And, you know, so I wrote a note and said, I hear about this Momentus XT hybrid SSD. Can you get one out to me? And they got one out to me within a couple of days, which was great. And they got me the latest one, which is similar to the Samsung, is that the product's evolving. So I got the 750 gig SATA 3 version. Again, I can't take advantage of the SATA 3, but the 750 gig is nice. But the key part of this is that it's a hybrid. It has SSD components, and that it has, I think it's an 8 gigabyte SSD style cache within it. And it actually uses the very fastest SSD type memory. There's a MLC and SLC, I believe, are the two different types of SSD memory technology. So this has 8 gigs of SLC SSD cache. And the thought is that it's supposed to be smart enough to look at your workflow and figure out what you do and speed things up. So I'm just going to give one benchmark here initially. So already I'm pretty much sold that this may be something I want to move to. So I'm going to give you one benchmark.
Okay.
When I benchmark the Samsung SSD, well, so my rotational is the Hitachi one, which was one of the fastest rotational drives, and that's a 500 gig drive. So one benchmark that I did, and I'm still doing some work on this, but when I tested my boot time on my MacBook Pro, with the rotational drive, the Hitachi 7K500 series, I think it is, 175 seconds. Okay.
Okay.
That's a long time, man.
Yeah.
And that's from, you know, seeing the little spinning wheel to when I would see with iStat menus that the drive read light turned off. So that's what I'm defining as startup time.
Okay.
When the machine is ready to roll.
Yep. And that's not the first boot. So all the caches and all that stuff are built in place and all of that good stuff, right?
Correct.
Okay.
All right. With the Momentus, Now, the first time I did a test of startup time, 60 seconds. So even it being kind of dumb and fresh out of the box and not even watching what I did, it's already faster. Or it did some learning, I think. I'm sure there was some stuff in the cache. When I did a restart and did it again, then it reduced it to 45 seconds.
Wow.
So it's learning. So if you just sit there restarting your computer all day, and I'm sure if I did it again, then it probably would have gotten a little faster.
Right, right.
Compare this to the Samsung SSD, which my startup time with that was 32 seconds.
Okay.
So 45 versus 30. So at least on this benchmark, which typically when you're talking system startup, you're talking about reading a whole bunch of tiny little files and maybe some large caches. But I think for the most part, you're reading mostly relatively small files.
Right.
And a whole bunch of them. Right. So, you know, 175 versus 60 or even 45 to me, I'm already sold in that respect. And the system feels happier, and I'm going to do more benchmarks and quantify some more stuff.
Yeah.
But it looks like the only thing is that I heard they had a lot of issues with it chirping. I think we actually got a question about that a few weeks ago from some of these would reportedly chirp or make a kind of beeping noise. And some of them would have random failures. I haven't had any.
You're right. It turned out that listener that had three beeps that we talked about with the hard drive and said maybe it's RAM and maybe it's this and maybe it's the other thing. It was actually the hard drive that was beeping or chirping, as it turns out. So, very, very good to remember that. That's good.
And actually, that's a request. Is that if you hear your machine doing something, if you can at all record it, because I misinterpreted what was being said as the Mac beeping, which the Mac beeping has very well defined meanings for the Mac beeping. Typically, it means something screwed up with the memory. But this was the drive beeping, or again, I would call it. But once I found some videos on YouTube, I'd call it more a chirp.
Yeah,
chirp,
sure.
Beep, you know, sure. Potato, potato.
Right, right.
Okay, but I'm thrilled with it so far. And 750 gigs, wow.
Yeah, that's great. That's huge. Oh,
again,
man,
great. What's it retailing for? Mentos XT 750 GB. Let's see. Do a quick... looking here, it looks the ballpark's bucks. About... Oh, wow, I'm actually finding some less than... 100. I found one for 150. Between 150 and 200 bucks, it looks. Yeah, about 175 seems to be the average price on that. So to me, that's a lot of bang for the buck.
That's great. Wow. Huh? Very cool. Any notable impact on battery life, or haven't you tested it long enough to?
Oh, none at all.
Okay.
No, I did a benchmark. So the Samsung SSD, I noticed I got about 30 with the battery that I have in my MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
I noticed that I would get about 30 minutes additional battery life.
Really?
Because the power draw on that drive was less than my rotational drive. So yeah, I would get about 30 minutes.
You had that big honking 7,200 RPM rotational drive in there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So with the SSD.
That makes sense.
With the SSD, and I think in general, though I think you and I battle, I think in general, most SSDs tend to draw less power than rotational drives. So that's not guaranteed.
We may battle on that. That is by and large not true, I think. I think some.
Well, the Samsung one, I did.
Yeah, but remember, John, you're not comparing it to a stock MacBook Pro drive. That's what I'm trying to point out is you have you've got a 500 gig 7200 RPM drive in there that is most definitely going to burn way more power than a 5400 that Apple would ship.
Yeah, could.
No, okay. Well, yeah, I mean in all the testing we've done, that has proven to be true. So
all right,
so you're comparing to a drive that's already drawing more power than most listeners are going to have. So
probably
this draws less than that. Maybe,
but
even,
comparing the two. So comparing the drive that I upgraded to, the rotational, which is the same Hitachi series, but yes, it's higher performing.
Right.
And the Samsung, I would see about 30 minutes.
Okay.
Increased battery life, and consistently I was able to reproduce that.
That's
so
good.
The only delta was that I was running the SSD instead of the rotational.
Right.
With the Momentus, the Seagate Momentus, no change in battery life.
Okay,
it's a rotational drive.
So, well, but it's a 7,200 RPM rotational drive. So most.
Right. So in essence, it's draw. I think I looked and it's drawing like maybe 2 watts, which is about average, I think, for most rotational drives.
Okay. So it's possible that for people running a stock Apple drive in their machine that they would see a battery life degradation with this Momentus XT?
perhaps if you're equating rotational speed to battery life, which it sounds like that's what you're doing, which I'll shake my fist at you because I don't know if I'd buy that. But
well, I'm just going on the fact that we've seen machines, okay, you know, with the stock Apple drives, and then you add, you know, if you add a 7,200 RPM, battery life goes down. Okay. In a very general sense. I'm not saying that that's happened with yours, but I'm suggesting that it has.
Right.
Right.
But as far as performance, again, I'm going to say that this thing, if you feel the need for capacity, but you want better performance than a pure rotational drive, then I think this is definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, at the price, $150 from Amazon. Holy cow. That's awesome. Yeah, man.
Yeah, because a 750 gig SSD, if they even exist.
Oh, yeah, forget it. Yeah.
Now, that, I think, would be way over $1,000. I don't think you could get away with a 750 gig SSD. If they even make them, I don't even know if they make them.
Let's see. That's a good question. No, the only, if you do a search for it, what comes up is this, the Momentus. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Due to,
because it's got that in it. Yeah.
All right.
Very interesting. So, good stuff. All right.
Well, let's, why not start off with cool stuff now?
What's that?
Why not start off with cool stuff now? But now we want to get to, we want to shake it up a bit here. So yeah. What are we going to do now?
Well, I'm going to talk about our first sponsor, and then we're going to, go on to Harvey. But our first sponsor is Smile Software. And this time we're going to talk about PDF Pen. PDF Pen for iPad. It has now been optimized for the Retina display and also adds folders and page rotation, which is so cool. So you can spin pages around, which may seem like something that doesn't, you know, that you wouldn't always want to do. But man, it is one of the things I do all the time in PDF Pen, especially if I get some PDF and it's because a lot of them I get are flipped. You know, if somebody, especially if you're doing faxes and things like that, where you or forms that you want to sign, you're definitely going to be manipulating these things. And being able to use the enhanced resolution, the Retina display really does make this a better experience. It makes it easier actually to manipulate this stuff. PDF Pen for the Mac and for the iPad, in a general sense, is a piece of software that allows you to do so much different manipulation and editing of PDFs. You can, of course, take a PDF and rearrange the pages. You can add pages. You can move things around. But then above and beyond that, you can go ahead and edit some of the text on PDFs. You can fill in forms. You can draw right on it if you want to. You can really go to town on this stuff. You can check out PDF Pen for the Mac at smilesoftware.com. PDF Pen for iPad, of course, you can get information at smilesoftware.com, but to buy it, obviously, you've got to go through the App Store since that's the only way to get stuff onto your iPad. And then with this, they've also released something for iCloud, and you can sync with iCloud PDFs from your Mac and your iPad. They have, if you've purchased PDF Pen directly from Smile and you want iCloud access for the Mac app, you can go purchase PDF Pen cloud access from the App Store. It's just 99 cents, and it will add that functionality then to the PDF Pen that you already have. So you can check all this stuff out at smilesoftware.com. Again, PDF Pen for Mac and for iPad. And there you go. I think that's got it all.
And here's a few data points.
Yeah, go ahead.
So if you want to stimulate the economy, I found two measurements here. So OWC sells the Intel 320 series 600 gigabyte SSD. That'll cost you a cool $1,194.99.
All right.
And then the one I was talking about, Samsung has a 512 gig. So their latest one, the 830 series. And the retail on that is $849.99. So you want it, they got it.
Awesome. Okay, so moving on to Harvey. Harvey has, he's got some questions about BusyCal, but But really, especially his first question about BusyCal really applies to just about any third party application that you might install on your Mac. So listen here. Harvey writes, for the launching in. Oh, wait. I'm reading my response to him. Sorry about that. Harvey writes, having a few problems. I have an early 2007 MacBook running Lion. Every time I open BusyCal, I get a pop-up window that says, do you want the application BusyCal.app to accept incoming network connections? It always says, allow, and I can allow or deny, and always allow. And I always click always allow. It says I can go in and change this in the system preferences in the firewall setting of my Mac so that it doesn't ask me all the time. I have done this. I go into security and privacy settings. I click on firewall and then advanced, and I added BusyCal to the list of programs that I want to always allow incoming network connections. Yet each time I open BusyCal, it does the same thing. Any thoughts? All right. So we'll answer this question, then we'll dive into the second one. Yeah, this is there are two reasons that you might get this error. Number one, it is if you don't have this persistent setting, which obviously you do. You've gone through and done that. But that's one reason. If you tell it that you want it to ask you, obviously it will. Number two is if macOS 10 thinks that this application is no longer code signed. And what we mean by code signing here is the developer, in this case, Busy Mac Software, registers with Apple, and Apple says, OK, yeah, we know who you are. And Apple gives them a little snippet of code that they can embed into their application. And when OS 10 sees this little bit of code, it says, aha, we know Apple says we know who you are. And if you screw some user, we know how to find you. So we're going to go ahead and grant your applications the ability to have some persistent privileges that you can't get if you don't code sign. And so in theory, this and Busy Mac is one of these. So in theory, this problem shouldn't be happening. But this code signing thing in OS 10, especially with regards to this firewall thing, can be very tenuous. And the solution, it sounds crazy, but the solution is to just delete BusyCal. You don't need to delete your data. You don't even need to delete your preferences. Just delete the application and download a new version. And, you know, reinstall it from the web, or if you have a disk image, you can just reinstall it from the disk image or the CD or however you want to get it. But putting the application back on your Mac fresh almost always will solve this problem, unless you have something to add, John.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm here. No, I was thinking.
Okay. All right. Well, that thinking is good. Yeah.
No, I'm thinking back and we saw this actually happen. So we've had people had a similar problem, oddly enough, though we'll shake our fist at them multiple times. iTunes.
Yeah, right.
I remember this happening as well. Apps.
That's right.
And what happened, I think, is that, and it was doing a software update of iTunes. And I think they either something bad happened on my computer, or I think maybe the package that they created was not created properly, because all of a sudden, and people wrote in on this and said, well, all of a sudden it says iTunes wants to know if it can accept incoming connections. Should I allow this? And it kept asking this question, and it was the exact same thing. Their code, the snippet in the application that was supposed to be the signature, was either not there or corrupted, or something bad happened. And the way to solve it was, to delete iTunes, re-download it, reinstall it, and then you wouldn't get the silly error anymore. So.
Cool. All right.
And we saw this problem too, actually, with the support article. So shaking fists at people here, but you know who did this? It was when I first got the Drobo, Dave. Is that, you know, I was running the Drobo console or Drobo dashboard software. And it was like searching for Drobo. Of course, the one that we have is an IP-based one. So, connections may have to go through the firewall. And I couldn't see it. And I'm like, what's going on here? And I went to their support and they said, oh, yeah, by the way, look in, the Apple firewall. And they have two things, one called DD Service D and one called DD Service 64D. And guess what? They were marked as deny incoming connections.
Yeah, that's
actually why I couldn't see the Drobo. As soon as I changed it to allow, then all of a sudden their dashboard app worked fine.
Yeah,
that it saw it. But otherwise, it was like it didn't exist on the network.
that's a problem that was introduced with Lion, because Lion kind of increased the the hoops through which an application or the bar above which an application must rise. And because those are separate apps, they don't fall into, they don't inherit the code signing that the main app gets, right? So when you run Duroba Dashboard and it says, you know, can I talk on the network? You say, or app or OS 10 asks if it can talk on the network, and you say yes, that it, that permission does not fall down the chain to these helper apps that get launched. So it requires app developers to think a little bit differently about how they're making their apps work, because yeah, like you said, I mean, you had to go to the support article and do this little workaround. And there are many pieces of software that that's the case with, and it's just, it is what it is for these packages that use these, you know, little helper apps.
Now, and from what I understand, not too much of a tangent, but it's going to be important, but I believe Mountain Lion is going to, what was the name of the technology?
Gatekeeper.
But I think Mountain Lion is almost, I believe Gatekeeper is going to require all code to have some form of signature. I don't think it's going to be as draconian as, you know, going through the App Store.
No.
But I think it's going to clamp down, and I think it's going to be a good thing because it's going to prevent, you know, malware, or at least, you know, should help guard against it. But I think they're right now, where it's kind of a hit or miss thing in Lion, it's going to be almost required in Mountain Lion. So get ready, folks.
Yeah, well, there's three settings for Gatekeeper. It's you only run code signed apps, only allow code signed apps to, or only allow Gatekeeper apps to do certain things, and then allow anything. And it will start with the middle of the road, which is what it should. It, you know, essentially Gatekeeper apps get the privileges that we're talking about already here, but any app can run, which is good. But yeah, if you set it to only allow, you know, Gatekeeper apps, then, you know, that's your choice. But yeah, we'll talk more about that, as I think Apple's still kind of tweaking out exactly, you know, how Apple is. They release these developer previews and they float these grand ideas. And then they come out of the gate and they say, here's what we're going to do, and this is the way it's going to be. And then they kind of stop and they listen for a really long time. And of course, out of the gate, you know, for the first week, people are going to be up in arms. They probably, you know, they probably read all that, but they sort of don't let it impact them. And then over time, they just sort of sit and listen and see what real developers come up with, and look at their support boards and look at the feedback they get. And then by the time they release it, they kind of, you know, have considered all of this feedback. And sometimes they don't change their mind and they stick with their initial position. But many times we've seen them where they say, OK, you know, we've thought about this and we've come up with a better way, you know, and that's not bad. So, it's probably best to kind of wait on this and talk a little bit more once we get some final details about Mountain Lion. But
The thing that concerns me is giving an option saying just allow anything to run, because at that point you might as well not even have it in place. On the other hand, I remember when Windows tried to do this with device drivers, and what happened is, I remember more than once I would get something saying, oh, this device driver isn't signed, you want to install it anyways? And I'm like, well, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, the same sort of thing. It's like, oh, why have this, you know, what can be very robust security if the user can just say, yeah, ignore it.
Right. Well, yeah, the part of the issue is forcing people into the App Store. That's where some of this gets touchy. That's kind of where. But again,
well, as long as it's not forcing App Store, but forcing people to code sign and not charging them an arm and a leg to do so, and making it easy. So you just develop your app and then, you know, drag and drop it on something and it adds the signature and then everything good. That's the way it should be. That they shouldn't make it. I don't know if you've went through the iPhone development process, but yeah, it gets kind of squirrely in that you got to generate, you know, a certificate, and you got to tie it to a device ID and ad hoc. It gets very much more involved than it should be, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, So with Gatekeeper, you do not have to, you don't even have to be a paying registered developer. You just can go in and become again, this is how they've proposed it. This may change, but you can just go in and for free, you can get an identified developer. But okay, so there's three sets of rules. Number one, and again, we'll see where the default comes in, but you can allow applications from the Mac App Store only. Then you can allow, second option is allow applications from the Mac App Store and identified developers, which are people that have gone through this free process and registered themselves. And that, I believe, is what it will default to. And then number three is allow applications from anywhere. So the scary one is that first one, allow applications from Mac's App Store only. That could get a little funny. So, you know, that would actually be really bad, if you ask me, because there are things that you cannot do and then get into the Mac App Store. You know, like Text Expander. I couldn't live without this utility. In fact, I'm shocked that you don't, especially that I'm shocked you don't use it. I know we were talking about it in the pre-show. You being Mr. Keyboard Shortcut, it baffles me that you don't use this. But anyway, it is a utility.
I got to keep people guessing.
That's right. It is a utility that I could not live without and will never be allowed in the Mac App Store unless, you know, fundamental rules about the App Store change. Mm-hmm. I don't think they will. Well, and you know, it comes from a seasoned Mac developer, well respected in the industry. You know, there's nothing wrong with this app, except that it requires access that, you know, doesn't work in the App Store. And that's OK. You know, it's fine. So anyway. Yeah.
Well, last I talked to Jean, she was also shocked. Hi, Jean.
Yeah, well, like, you got it.
I can't believe you don't use one of these.
It's frankly mind-boggling, but you know, that's how it goes. I couldn't do these on the fly show notes without it. And you now, you know, this is your responsibility. So you're going to have to find a way. And
what?
Text Expander is, you know, this is the last show I'm doing them for. And our listeners now they're going to be expecting this.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Question number two was, let me get back to Harvey's questions here. He says, number two, the second issue I have is syncing between iCal and BusyCal, and now it doesn't always work. I don't seem to have the same calendars in each program. And that is true. iCal and BusyCal are now both, it's the right way to say this. They're both just client apps to the various servers that you can connect to, iCloud, MobileMe for a little while longer, and then Google Calendar, or really any CalDAV server, you can point either one of these apps at and they'll work just fine. But what happens is when you point BusyCal at a CalDAV server, it saves that in a way that iCal sees as stuff being on my Mac. And it's going to get confusing if you try to use both interchangeably. My advice is pick one and go with it. There's no real reason to use both, at least not that I've come up with. So yeah. Make one your default and go with it. Obviously for me, that's BusyCal without question, because it's so much more robust and easier to use. But if your preference is iCal, then just live with that. But I can't see a good reason to want to live in both. So I know that's not really an answer, but it is the answer that I have anyway. You still use iCal, right, John?
Sure.
All right. Everett, ask away.
Hi, I have a question for you. In your opinion, and I think I know what I would do, would you either A, get a 32 gig iPad 2 refurbished off of the Apple Store for $450, or would you get the new iPad 2, or the new iPad 3, excuse me, for $500 and only get 16 gigs? I'm leaning towards the 32 gig. Are there anything that will come back to bite me later, like such as what they did with the iPod Touches and old iPhones to not let them update to the new iOSs? All right. Thanks.
Good question. So let's think about the technology here. My answer out of the gate is I agree with you. I would go with the larger iPad 2. If all you have is $500 to spend, do the larger iPad 2, the larger capacity iPad 2 over the iPad 3, because there are two major technological differences in the iPad 3. Number one is the Retina display. So it's a higher resolution display. And then number two is the graphics chip in there to keep up on that. There's also a larger battery, but as far as we're all concerned, it doesn't matter because at best, the battery life is the same on the two. And some people are actually finding in some of their tests that the iPad 2 battery life outlasts the iPad 3. And that's because this screen requires more juice. So, you know, from that standpoint, I don't think there are going to be iOS updates that will, you know, I don't think there's any good reason. It's basically the same CPU and all of that stuff. So there's no reason that Apple would have to leave the iPad 2 behind for, you know, because it's just not fast enough to keep up. There will, I'm sure, be apps that are Retina display only. So be prepared for that. There aren't any yet. Be prepared for that, or be prepared for, you know, a loss of functionality of something because you don't have a Retina display. That said, we're not seeing a huge amount of that on the iPhone. And we've had Retina display there with, you know, with the iPod Touch and the iPhone for a while, but that would be the only thing. So yeah, I think if that's your deal, I'd go and do that. I'd get the 32 gig version and enjoy. John,
here's what I think. Well, I'll tell you something that I ran into here, and this is I'm just into the fish shakes or finger now fish shake at iTunes. So, you know, I've been installing apps and other things on my iPhone. So I have the iPhone 4 Verizon version, CDMA 16, and I went for the 16 gig. You know, I'm like, well, that should be plenty of memory, right? Well, the other day I was syncing it to my computer using everybody's favorite piece of software, iTunes. And all of a sudden I got a notification on the iPhone screen saying, iTunes cannot sync 10 items. Please run iTunes for details. I'm like, okay, I launch iTunes.
Sure.
See my device in the sidebar. And I'm like, yeah. And I think you can guess what the problem was, Dave.
Well, yeah, go ahead and tell us what the problem was. Yeah.
Well, here's the problem. So I clicked on my device and I looked at the memory consumption bar. And guess what? I had filled, there was point something megabytes RAM free.
Not RAM, storage space.
Oh, I'm sorry, storage space on the device free. Yeah, the little bar graph it shows on the bottom. And I'm like, well, okay, that must be the problem. So I went to the first place. You know, I looked at the distribution of, you know, how I had my stuff laid out. And actually, I was on the heavy side of my podcast. I saved 10 episodes. So I said, you know what, save 5 episodes of each. Change that. And all of a sudden, the memory bar reflected the memory was available. And but it would, the notification on the iPhone and iTunes were totally useless in diagnosing this. If I hadn't noticed, again, looking at the device profile that the memory was full, I would not know what was going on.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying is that 16 gigs may be something that you will eventually exceed. So yeah, go for the 32.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's no question about it. Yeah. You're because especially with movies and stuff to put on there and use, you're going to fill that thing up faster than you think, unless you really aren't going to, you know, be playing movies at all on it. But I
do little movies, but actually I've gotten another notification saying, oh, wait, you have 400 photos in your photo library. I guess that's a hard limitation on at least the 16 gig device. And it's like, you got to delete some. I'm like, oh, really?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never had a 16 gig device or 16 gig iPod or iPhone. So I've never run into that. But yeah, that's an interesting one. I have way more than, I mean, I've got whatever, what do I have, the 64 gig iPhone now? I forget. I'll tell you, but I have, you know, 700 photos or something on it. Yeah. I get the 64. I learned my lesson. I used to get like the middle of the road one and it always drove me crazy, probably because I'm always installing stuff and messing with it. And now I just spend the extra $100 and buy the big one and it's totally worth it. It's also the cheapest, you know, way you can, cause you double your RAM, you know, you pay $100 to go from whatever the lowest level to the middle level. And then you pay another $100 and you double completely from there. So it's like better bang for your buck. That's good. More storage for your dollar. All right. Everett had an interesting question. We'll let him pose his question. Here you go, Everett.
Hi. I've had an interesting issue on my early 2008 aluminum iMac. And the issue is that whenever I have a Bluetooth device, such as a mouse or a wireless trackpad connected, I get this really weird mouse delay. Like, I'll move it this way, and then it'll jump across the screen and, like, move even though I have my finger off the trackpad and stuff like that. And then I also have this issue with my... hold on. I think it's a 2011 MacBook Pro. Yeah, 2011 MacBook Pro. Not with the built-in trackpad, but with the Bluetooth trackpad. I did not migrate from either computers. And they both back up to time machine. I don't know if that's important at all. And this is with both a Magic Mouse and a Bluetooth trackpad from Apple. Thanks, and I'll talk to you later.
All right, John, what do you think about this? That's a weird thing.
Wow. Well, you know, he just mentioned here, so we didn't get specifics, but I'm going to tell you because someone else that I was tweeting with brought up a similar question, and he was saying, you know what? My Magic Mouse on my iMac, when I'm under heavy Wi-Fi usage, seems to be jumpy. Now, Everett mentioned that he mentioned Time Machine. Okay, now he didn't mention if it's a hardwired drive or wireless. Now I'm going to assume wireless. Or did he say it a time capsule? I don't know if he threw in that tidbit or not.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, clearly, it's probably safe to assume that he's got some level of wireless happening there.
Right. Now, the thing is, and unfortunately, you kind of wonder why this is happening, but Bluetooth and Wi-Fi can potentially be operating on the same frequencies. Now, they are using, as far as I know, but both using something called spread spectrum, which is supposed to reduce the chance of interference, but I don't think it totally eliminates it.
Well, especially if Everett's in an apartment building or somewhere where there's a lot of different Wi-Fi networks happening, Bluetooth may be competing for, you know, Bluetooth uses, yeah, Wi-Fi, you're focusing on a channel and picking where it's going to live. Bluetooth kind of, you know, like you said, spreads around the spectrum and tries to find its little holes. But if there is a lot of Wi-Fi activity, even if it's not Everett's, as long as there's
Wi-Fi. Well, yeah. I think they all do. They all spread it. Again, I think it's all technically called spread spectrum, and that it distributes it. So as long as you're not on the same channel, you're not going to get 100% overlap. You may get some overlap.
Right.
But Blue, and I got to wonder why they do this. So, and I'm just looking at a quick search here. And the problem is, so 2.4 gigahertz, what uses this? Well, Bluetooth does. Wi-Fi certainly does. Microwave ovens do. Cordless phones do. So if you're talking, especially if you're in a densely populated area, you're probably going to have a lot of people using either cordless phones, microwaves, Wi-Fi. Who knows what else? And it could be just a matter of there being too much happening. Now, how can you find out what's happening? Well, you could use some of the tools that come to my mind, iStumbler or what's some of the others?
Air radar.
What's your favorite, Dave? Okay, Air Radar. Yeah, I think you got to toss them some money for that. But
you do. Trial. Yeah, I like it better than iStumbler. It tends to shows a little more detail and once you bought it, then you got it. So
sure. Yeah, iStumbler. You know, it's a freebie.
Right.
So I like that you can donate to them, and I believe you can. If you can, then I have. But one thing you may want to consider is, so first you got to think about what things are within my control. Well, one thing that is within your control is the frequency that your base station is on. So, you know, or you could try to eliminate the competing Wi-Fi base stations, but you know, that could be difficult in a densely populated area. So the best you can do, and actually I had to do this the other day, I was having connection problems and I did a rescan of my neighborhood and I noticed that some things had changed as far as, you know, new neighbors having, you know, things on channels that I used to occupy. So I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to go to the other one that has less population here.
That's a good piece of advice right there. Actually, do you know, every 6 months, do another scan. And I'm not totally out in the woods. I've got neighbors within reach of me. Well, but I'm not totally isolated here. I mean, I'm certainly within range of my neighbors' networks. And like I said, we had some people moving across the street, and their house is far away. This guy must have a honking router. It's some Cisco thing. But you know, it definitely impacted what we do here, and I had to make some changes. And, you know, our Sonos runs on its own wireless channel and, you know, all this other stuff. So, yeah, that's a good idea. Do that every 6 months. Just run, like John said, run iStumbler or Air Radar. And just see what's around and then tweak yours if you can.
Or, I mean, the other thing is if you can, you know, if you're doing Wi-Fi and you're cool with it, maybe switch your Wi-Fi to 5 gigahertz and eliminate that as part of the equation. So there are some downsides to doing that. But if all your devices can support it and you can get away with the relatively, you know, shorter range.
Yeah.
Then maybe that's another option. In my case, I can't because like my TiVo, you know, right now. That's the only thing holding me back. You know, I got to take your advice at some point, Dave, and get one of the power line adapters, because the only thing holding me back, I think, in my household is my TiVo, which is an 802.g device. So I have to put my time capsule in compatibility mode.
Yeah, I'd be curious.
If it wasn't for that, then I think every other device in my house can run on 5 gig. N,
no, which... not your iPhone.
Oh,
your iPhone does N, but 2 gigahertz N, not 5.
Apple, Kurt. But at least I could take the device out of compatibility mode, which that may help. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it probably would if the TiVo's doing a lot of chattering on the network. All right. So, Tim is up next. Tim asks, earlier this week, I mistakenly deleted a file and I emptied the trash. I thought, no problem, I'll just retrieve it from Time Machine. However, I couldn't because my Time Machine stopped backing up around April 15th. No warning or anything. It just stopped. I tried to force a backup and it stayed in preparing to backup state forever and never started a backup. I have 2 iMacs backing up to 1 time capsule. I checked the other Mac and its last backup was also around April 15th. I ended up erasing my Time Machine and creating a new backup, and all that now works fine. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on what may have happened. I think I can rule out a bad Time Machine preference file since 2 iMacs stopped backing up. Could this be my time capsule is failing? All right. So first of all, this is, you know, another word to the wise here. Number one, Time Machine does a really bad job of alerting you when it has a problem and does not complete a backup. In that it does not
it
alert
doesn't.
You. Right. It does. I mean,
well, sometimes it does. I've seen it in the preference pane. Sometimes it'll say, you know, backup delayed, but I don't think it's proactive.
No.
About telling you that. And then you have to go to Time Machine preference pane and you will see, let me bring it up right now, Time Machine. And you'll see in the latest, like even now I'm looking, latest backup. And in red letters, it says delayed and there's a little I. And I click on the I and it says, oh, Time Machine error. The backup disk is not available. But I didn't get any proactive notification that this was a problem. Now, this one I think is a problem because typically the Drobo sometimes doesn't mount as quickly as Time Machine would like. Or at least when I wake my machine, that's the only thing I've seen. So sometimes I'll get this notification. But again, unless I looked in the Time Machine pref pane, I wouldn't have seen it.
Yeah. You can also see it in the menu bar. Sometimes you'll get an exclamation point on your your Time Machine.
Yes.
And you
Good
can
point.
Click on the menu option, even if there's no exclamation point, and see at least when the latest backup was. And it'll give you a little bit of status there. But the point is, there is no warning that says, hey, you haven't backed up, you know, dude, this is a problem, you know. So that's number one. Number two, you listen to Mac Geek Gab, so you know that one backup ain't enough, right? You got to do 2, you know, be that a clone or something
3.
So that you've got
3, sir.
I know. Yeah. I agree. And then you got to archive, but you know, but at least not one. You have to have more than one if you want to truly be backed up. So that's that. Now, as far as what happened,
I know
all the circumstances would point to it being the time capsule because it happened on 2 different Macs at the same time. Now, maybe your time capsule, for whatever reason, went offline and caused your backups to get corrupted if two things were backing up simultaneously, because of course the computers don't coordinate with each other, which also sucks because, you know, you're contending for network resources and disk resources, when that's happening. But thank you, Apple, for not making Time Machine smart enough to do that and then selling us the time capsule. But that's kind of how that goes. So I would keep a weary eye on your, maybe even a sharper than weary eye. I'd be weary of that time capsule is what I'm trying to say. Keep an eye on it and see what happens. It may be that it was just some, file corruption thing, but the disk is okay. But keep an eye on it and get another backup going too, just in case that time capsule fails. That's my advice. I'm sticking to it. There is okay. A little cool stuff found we can add about this, John.
Where do you want to look? I would look also, Dave, in the console, because the console reveals much that is hidden.
Yes.
And that the one thing that I've seen a lot of times, and this is when I get wary, when I see a Time Machine backup and you can see it in the Time Machine menu, in the menu bar, but it'll say indexing backup. I'm like, oh, what's going on here? But also the console, if you filter on backup D, will show you, why it gave up trying to do a backup. You got to filter on that because, the console is full of all sorts of, wonderful geeky stuff and you don't want to get overwhelmed. So I've seen that too. And actually I'm reaching back and I think I had a situation where for whatever silly reason, my machine was not backing up my MacBook Pro. It would just give up. And then when I use something, I forget the name of the utility, but there's a utility that shows you the contents of a Time Machine backup. And it showed that numerous
Backup Loop is the one I've used. LOUPE. We'll put a link in the show notes. But that.
Yeah, there's another that's a freebie that I can't remember, but I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Okay.
But I think what happened is that I think I eventually fixed the problem and that I think I booted my machine into safe mode, which is something that it fixes a lot of things that may be broken or it kind of does a reset on a lot of things on your machine. And there's, of course, an article about that. We'll link to that as well. You'll just love the show notes if and when they come out. No, I'm running behind on actually the last batch. I'm still working on updating them. Sorry, but no, I had a problem where at one point I was like, what's going on here? And I looked with the other tool, which I'll link to, and I saw that backups had occurred or no. Well, there were placeholders, but it said, well, the size of it is 0 bytes. And I'm like, what? And then I looked in the console and it was like, well, there's some other thing wrong. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know how I came up with booting in safe mode. I know that can fix a number of things like corrupted kernel extension caches and then some other things, but. Hey, cool. It can't hurt to do it, right?
No.
Can't hurt to boot in the safe mode, right?
No. No, because it cleans out a lot of caches and stuff like that. And if that's your problem, then yeah, absolutely. So I did want to mention, you mentioned the looking in the console. And that certainly is a way of seeing things. Jim, a premium subscriber, actually sent in a suggestion for cool stuff found, which is so perfect for this particular issue that I'm going to share it here instead. Mm-hmm. And it's a little dashboard widget called Time Machine Buddy. And really all it does, it's free. And all it does is takes the logs from the console and coalesces them all together and filters out all the other stuff and really kind of makes it easy for everyone to make sense of the Time Machine backup logs. So highly recommend taking a look at that to see what's going on because those logs tell you, well, frankly, far more than you're going to get out of anything else from Apple about Time Machine. So that's a really handy thing. Time Machine Buddy. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's available from Apple's, dashboard widget downloader place. So Jim, thank you for sending that in. All right. We've got a couple of other little tips to throw in here. Was it Time Tracker, John? That's just popping into my head as the other thing that you can use to look at Time Machine. Is that right? Is that Time Tracker?
Oh, let's see. Time Tracker. And that was from Charles Soft.
Yep. The pacifist folks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, and pacifist. If you got a package and you want to know what's in it, of course, a Mac package,
of course,
then this is the software to do that sort of thing. And actually, I was fiddling around with, the other day with Quick Look. And apparently they have a tie into Quick Look. So if something is Quick Look compatible, it'll let you peek into it.
Cool.
I don't know if we'll get to that question, but no, I was experimenting with Quick Look stuff. And all of a sudden I noticed that when I highlighted something that Pacifist knew about, it said, oh yeah, hold on. Pacifist is thinking about this. And it showed me the contents of a installation package. So definitely worth it. $20 shareware. I think it's great. But yeah, so he also has Time Tracker, which is, it's very basic, but it will show you what's in your, once you mount the Time Machine volume, it'll show you what is in each backup.
Cool. All right, we've got a couple. We're well over our hour here that we try to allot. You know, we started this show allotting 40. We started the whole concept of this show with about a 45-minute time frame. Mm. You folks convinced us that going to an hour is all right, and of course we stretch that. But we do want to wrap up a little bit. But there are two things that we want to share with you because they're great little tips, and they come from two of our listeners. Number one is from Will. He says, I wanted to follow up on the backup show in terms of getting a backup computer. He says, I think it's a great idea to have another machine as and a bootable backup to allow you to restart immediately. But if you don't have another machine, or even if you do, you might want to remember about Apple's joint venture program. It comes primarily from the retail stores, but gives you a fair amount of support. One of the things they give you is that if you take your machine in for a repair that will take longer than 24 hours, they will loan you at no extra cost a 15-inch MacBook Pro or a 13-inch MacBook Air preloaded with Lion, iLife, iWork, and MS Office. So, yeah, this Apple joint venture program is an interesting thing. It's $500 and it costs $500 for up to 5 systems. One system could be your Mac, your iPad, and your iPhone. So it's essentially for, you know, 5 people, and it's built for businesses. But, you know, certainly there are those of us where, you know, in our homes, we might, you know, qualify to, at least from a cash flow standpoint, that you know, this extra $500 a year makes sense. Of course, at home, you might be able to just use another computer you have, whereas in a business, you know, if everybody's working all day long, you know, having this available, but it gets you this Apple joint venture thing. It's about a year old, I think, and it gets you access to Genius appointments faster. So if you're in an area where, you know, you don't, the Genius Bar appointments are always filled up, that's another little benefit. They'll set you up. They'll transfer stuff over. They'll do training. It's basically you pay your $500 and then you're, you know, you kind of get the support that you need from Apple each year. So definitely worth checking out. John, you want to tell everybody about, or you want to read people Duffy's thing about the printing?
Duffy. Hey, Duffy, how's it going? All right, hold on. There we go. Good stuff. Oh, wait, hold on. Duffy. All right. I'm just going to spit it out here.
Go.
So if you have problems, yeah. So Duffy touched on this and he wrote to both Dave and I guess, about this. Sometimes your printing system just gets totally messed up and you can't print. Here's how you get around this. So if you have a problem printer, so how do you get to your problem printer? Well, of course you go to System Preferences and you click on Print and Fax, and you'll see a list of printers on the left side or some other things. Now, in my case, I see my inkjet and I see my laser printer. Well, say things are just not printing. Well, what do you do? What do you do? Well, what I would do, Dave, is I would control click on the printer itself and you will see a choice here. Well, you see two choices, or you should. One is set default printer, which you can do that. The other is reset printing system. And to the best of my knowledge, what that does, that basically clears out everything that has to do with that printer and starts it from scratch.
Yep. Well, no, that's not what it does. I mean, that's one of the things it does. It deletes every printer you have and starts your entire printing system from scratch as though you had reinstalled
the... Wait, it deletes all the printers?
Correct. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if you want to do that. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a last resort method. You know, what Duffy said was he had gone through I'll read Duffy's email because it's actually a thing. He says, I was helping a client with his uncooperative printer. I had tried deleting it and re-adding it a few tries. What I hadn't tried was resetting it. And he talks through resetting. And he said, as soon as I reset the printing system, I re-added the printer, worked like a charm. Unfortunately, this was a very old printer using a parallel to USB adapter. And shortly thereafter, it stopped working properly again because the drivers aren't all that compatible. So he's sort of stuck in a spot where he's got to probably just get a new printer that's, you know, I mean, remember, a parallel printer was never meant to be Mac compatible. But, you know, in most cases for troubleshooting, if your printing system is tied in knots, and it can be even once you've deleted a printer, you just wipe that out and start from scratch. It does require you re-adding all of your printers, but most of us don't have more than one or two, so it's not that big of a deal. So, but yes, it is, you know, you want to be careful about it.
No, you're right. Okay. And I found an article, HT1341, Mac OS X, how to reset the printing system. Yes, you are correct.
Yavo. Yeah. But it's handy. It, you know, you
what
think-
does it do? It deletes all queues and jobs, resets all printer settings to their default by deleting configuration files, performs permission check on the temp directory. Ooh. And anything that was there is nuked. Okay. Yeah. It's the nuke and pay for your printing system.
That's exactly Wonderful. What it is. Yeah. Oh, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Very, very good. All right, folks, if you want to contact us, you can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Or feedback at macgeekgab.com.
That's right. Or you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is?
4-335.
I'll take that. That works. Yeah, sure. You can Skype us to MacGeekGab. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/MacGeekGab.
Really?
Yeah, you can.
If you can find us on Facebook, you could probably find us on Twitter. And if you want to find us on Twitter, the show is, well, these are all prefaced by twitter.com. If you want to find the show, it's MacGeekGab. You want to find me, John F. Braun. You want to find him, Dave Hamilton. You want to find that other guy that's flying somewhere, Pilot Pete. And of course, the Mac Observer is Mac Observer. It couldn't be easier.
It couldn't. That's right. We would very much like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast for converting this show and every show into AAC and adding all those chapters and links and all of that good stuff. We also would like to thank Cashfly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace this month includes BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile, Gazelle.com to sell all your old Apple and, well, all your old Apple stuff, and VMware. You get 10% off with the MGG coupon of VMware Fusion. So be sure to use that. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is what we said before.
Is that what I said? Is that what you said?
It is.
Well, what else do we need to say, Dave?
Well, we need to say, don't get caught, because otherwise... Gotcha!